While there's a growing gap between rich and poor here in the United States, nearly half the world lives on the equivalent of $5 a day, many even less. Significant strides have been made in recent years to combat global hunger and poverty. But the difficulties in the past few years and misunderstandings over what American foreign aid actually does add to the challenge. We're joined now by Baron Seeger. He heads the World Food Program USA, which provides assistance in about 120 countries from Afghanistan to Zambia. Baron, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rick. I'm excited to be here today to talk more about what's happening around the world.
All right. Now, just so we can kind of get the context here, you're part of World Food Program USA, and that's, I understand, a part of the United Nations World Food Program. Tell us, what does the United Nations World Food Program do, and how does the United States World Food Program USA relate to that?
The UN World Food Program, think about boots on the ground, 20,000 staff in 120 countries, feeding up to 160 million people a year. And then the World Food Program USA, we're the U.S. affiliate. We're charged with engaging the private sector, educating our policymakers, and also making sure that our board is engaged to help drive growth in the United States. We're also here to amplify the voices of those who are served by the World Food Program.
Now, when we look at the value of taxpayer money being invested in developmental aid and foreign aid, I think there's a big difference between old-fashioned aid and modern development aid. If somebody's skeptical about the wisdom of the way we spend money through the World Food Program, give me an example of what was worse, in your estimate, about old-fashioned aid that may have been well-meaning but was actually counterproductive, and how that's better now.
Well, I would say that the cost to provide a meal is 50 cents. By the way, a school meal is about 35 cents for a meal. Last year, the World Food Program fed 15 million school children. So what I would say is that there's really a dual need. One is you've got to feed people that are hungry, that are on the verge of famine. That's an immediate need. But the World Food Program is doing a lot of innovation with taxpayer money, from school feeding to using some funding to help us train smallholder farmers to provide sustainability and allowing us to invest in green energy so that communities have access not only to food, but also to water.
Is there a growing realization that money is better funneled directly to small organizations on the ground rather than to governments in the developing world?
There's no doubt about it. And we have thousands of implementing partners, by the way. So it's never just one organization that's doing it all on their own. We're convening. We're all sitting down at the table together, making sure that we're not stepping on each other's toes to make sure that the needs of communities are being met.
You know, a lot of us don't realize that when we support Lutheran Hunger Aid or Oxfam or Catholic Hunger Aid and so on, that organization is then taking that money and empowering organizations that are really already established in these difficult corners of the world. And that just makes more sense, doesn't it, to empower an organization that is with people who live there, who know the rhythm of life and who have the respect and the trust of the people they're going to be helping.
Absolutely. Most of the staff at the World Food Program are nationals of these countries. There's a level of trust that they have built. They're also helping us identify the problems and the solutions in the local communities.
One thing that I'm curious about, and you can help us with this, is structural poverty between the rich and developed world and the developing world with trade policies that make it hard for poor countries to process their raw materials. They have to export it raw, and then other people make the serious money. I mean, you can sell coffee beans and make a little, or you can sell roasted coffee beans and make more. You can sell peanuts and make a little. You can sell peanut butter and make a lot more. Is it still true that a lot of trade policies are aggressive policies by the rich world to get the raw materials unprocessed so the money can be made outside of the poor world?
So I would say that we're trying to change that formula. And this is part of my role. We're doing a lot of convening right now with large agricultural companies to see how we can share the wealth, if you will, so that more importing can be done, but also so that lower-income countries can have the skills that they need to grow and export their agriculture products. I think we're seeing that. We're seeing a lot of movement. But one of my biggest initiatives is working with the private sector to engage them, to use their assets, and make sure that the whole world can do what we're doing here in the United States.
Baron, tell me how the empowerment of women is now factoring into your fight to end hunger.
So we are doing a lot of training of women, particularly smallholder farmers, more than 50% of the beneficiaries of the World Food Program, and giving them the skills, the machinery, the know-how to run a business, to sell their product, not only within their country domestically, but also how to take it internationally for market.
So, you know, historically, women have been kept down in different traditional societies by the men. And people are recognizing, people in the trenches, that it's the women who will get it done. And that's enlightened new development aid. What about the importance of water, bringing water to people who are trying to have that dignity of healthy children and getting on top of things?
Food and water are the two most critical elements, not only of survival, but think about irrigation. So in a lot of countries right now, we're using green energy, solar energy to pump the water. We were just in on a field visit and saw where 40,000 gallons a day are being pumped out of one well, not only to grow crops, but also provide water for thousands and thousands of people.
Wow. It's amazing to think that the average lot in life for many women, I mean, a big percent of the women on this planet is to abandon their families every morning and walk for water. If we could just help bring water to these communities.
It's not acceptable. And then when girls and women have to walk, it also opens them up for violence, for trafficking. And so we're working very hard with the World Food Program and our partners to make sure that every single person has access to water. Again, not just to drink, but also we have got to irrigate the crops to make sure that they grow, and there you've got the sustainability of communities.
Baron Seeger brings more than 20 years' experience in growing philanthropic organizations. Today, he's the president of the UN's World Food Program, USA, and he's updating us on Travel with Rick Steves on the fight against global poverty and hunger in the middle of these especially challenging times. Baron, I think the old-fashioned aid was sending bags of rice that say USAID on them and dropping them on a harbor, on a pier somewhere, not understanding that messes up the market and demoralizes local farmers, and pretty soon the fields in that poor country are not even planted because they're just eating the wrong kind of food and the wrong kind of culture. There's even a movement now, I think, among a lot of very progressive aid agencies to think about smart ways of getting cash to farmers instead of sending food to those countries. What's your take on that?
I'm a huge believer in this. When there are functioning marketplaces, the best solution is a cash-based transfer that goes to the mom, the family, typically it's $75 a month, to allow them to purchase produce, it's typically beans, rice, oils, locally. And by the way, Rick, what it also does, it provides sustainability within that community because they're buying products and produce locally.
Baron, I think a lot of American taxpayers are a little bit cynical about foreign aid because they're skeptical that it does much good. And there are these sort of basic arguments against foreign aid. I'm going to give you a chance now as the president of the World Food Program to refute these. Somebody might say, we've already spent so much money and there's still hungry people. Why don't we just spend our money somewhere else? It doesn't work.
So a couple things I would say. One is we have to remember that we saw 9 years of decline in hunger, but we had COVID, we have conflict. And so you did see a spike. I am confident that the numbers of hunger are going to decline again. I just don't know when. I would also say that the 120,000 individuals supporting the World Food Program USA would disagree with that statement, because a lot of them are advocating their policymakers to make sure that everybody knows that hunger is a priority and everybody deserves a meal. It is a human right.
It's a human right. And historically, if you look at the trajectory, the number of hungry people has gone down dramatically in the last couple of generations, while the population of the planet has doubled. There's just a real decline, like hugely, except for the last couple of years when it's ticked up. Another complaint is, if you feed the poor, they'll just have more babies.
So unfortunately, what you see in so many different countries, because child mortality is so high, a lot of women have several children because there's unfortunately a belief that a lot of children will die. And they do, by the way. So our job is to not pass judgment on the number of children that a mother or a parent may have. Our job is to make sure that everybody has access to a meal, that children are nourished to reach their full potential. It is not up to me to decide how many children are born and how many children are not born. My job is to make sure that children have access to nutritious meals and that 15 million people particularly children, young people, have access to school meals to allow them to reach their full potential.
Another common argument against development aid with taxpayer dollars is the United States already does give a huge percent of its budget to, you know, foreign aid. Just how much do we give, and how does that relate to other wealthy countries?
So, Rick, I would say if you ask the average American, they would think it's 20% of the budget, where indeed it is 1%. And so we have to keep that 1%, if not more, in play. And I would remind everybody that we did avoid famine last year. We have COVID, we have costs going up, we have wars happening, and we avoided famine. And while no individual should have to die of hunger, we were projecting widespread famine last year. It did not happen. The reason it did not happen was because of the U.S. government and their support for the UN, World Food Program, and other organizations like ours.
This is Travel with Rick Steves, and today we're talking with the president and CEO of the World Food Program USA, Barron Seeger. Barron's getting us up to date on the work of the World Food Program in countries he's recently visited. To learn more about the work of the World Food Program USA, you can visit WFPUSA.org. So it's important for you to be out on the road and knowing what's happening in the field. It must have been exciting for you to actually get to go to these countries. I just want to kind of go through this in a report from the field kind of way. What did you learn when you went to Central America? What are the exciting issues? What are the challenges?
I would say when I went to Central America, I was overwhelmed at the World Food Program's positive response to school feeding. It was clear that school feeding was bringing communities together, that young people were going to school because they were able to get a meal. And in many cases, this was the one meal a day that a child would get.
When I was in Guatemala recently, the big talk among farmers was the dry corridor caused by climate change, a place that used to not be dry, used to be fertile, and now it's almost becoming like a desert. What did you learn about the dry corridor?
So in the dry corridor, I learned about innovative solutions that are being used with farmers. I looked at a number of projects where green energy, solar power was being used to pump water from the ground to not only provide drinkable water to communities, but very, very importantly, to make sure that the crops were being irrigated. And by the way, enough crops not only to feed the local communities, but in many cases to take those products to the market to earn an income.
That is so exciting when people can get into the global economy. I know that's what farmers down there want to do. They want to stay on the land and produce and sell what they produce. What about Lebanon? You were just in Lebanon.
Yeah, I was just in Lebanon. Lebanon has suffered from a series of unfortunate events. They were a big importer of wheat from Ukraine, and then they had a port blast. So when we complained about inflation here in the United States, I think about Lebanon, 2,000% inflation. But I would also say that I've seen firsthand how farmers are stepping up with the support of the World Food Program to grow crops domestically. We're also using hydroponics, which allows you to grow a plant without soil, just with moderate amounts of water. And I've saw a huge food distribution system making sure that men, women, and children, and the elderly have access to nutritious food supplies. So I would say, you know, a temporary situation, I hope, in Lebanon. They've had a tough go of it between the war between Russia and Ukraine and then with the port blast. But we're now feeding about 1.8 million people, also using cash vouchers because there are functioning marketplaces. I saw them. I went with a young couple to the store because the husband and wife didn't have jobs. It was a temporary fix, not a permanent fix, a very temporary fix to get food and agriculture at a local market.
And you were in Poland, right on the Ukrainian border. I know the tragedy in Ukraine has had a real serious impact on the affordability of food in the most hungry corners of our planet. What did you learn in Poland?
Well, I would say, Rick, 3 weeks after the war, we took a group of private sector philanthropists to the field, to the border, to see firsthand the need that was being created. And we went to a train station to see so many women and young people that were getting off the train. They didn't have food, and they could only take with them what was in their hands. So we weren't working in the Ukraine before the war. Now we've scaled up our efforts, feeding millions of people. But I would say that Ukraine, as we talked about before, Some of the work that we do is in kind, meaning that we're providing the food directly, but also there are functioning marketplaces in Ukraine where people just need a hand up. They need a temporary cash voucher so they can buy vegetables and rice and beans at the local market.
Baron, it's so interesting to me, the more people learn about this, the more they want to do something about it. I know I've been fortunate to be able to travel in these countries, and it makes me come home and want to make a difference. What is your advice for an American citizen to make a difference in helping out with the mission of the World Food Program?
So, Rick, I would start by saying how overwhelmed I am with the generosity of people in the United States. We have so many more people who have joined this journey of ours to solve global hunger, who also believe that hunger shouldn't happen and that food is a basic right. So we're frequently asked questions about how can I help? And there are a lot of ways that people can help. Number one, every time I go to the field, I never come back from the field without somebody saying, can you please amplify my voice, tell my story? So when you're sitting at the dinner table tonight, enjoying food, please have a conversation about food and what it means to people. And use your social media channels to use your voice to elevate the voices of others.
Baron, just to close out this discussion, if you met a skeptic who maybe doesn't even care about love thy neighbor, but just wants to be more secure, how can you frame this whole tax dollar expense as a practical investment issue? How can you make the case that in the privacy of the voting booth, you can be totally in your own interest and still see the practicality of investing in the fight against hunger south of our border?
So I have been approached on a number of occasions with somebody who will say, why are we helping, quote unquote, these people? They're not part of the United States. And my feedback is, who gave us the power to decide who lives and who dies, whether they're in the United States or outside the United States? I happen to believe that when a young person gets a school meal, when they go to school, they have the ability of being productive human beings. And it is not within my power or anybody else's power to make the decision of who gets ahead and who does not. I just happen to believe personally, and I say this all the time, that whether you are here in the United States or whether you are halfway around the world, you are part of my family. And I have an obligation to make sure that every single person on this earth has access to a proper, nutritious meal, and they're able to reach their full potential. And most people, when I say that, agree with me. It is hard to disagree with me or anybody that hunger is not a basic human right.
Baron Seeger, thank you so much for joining us, and best wishes with your important work as the CEO and president of the World Food Program USA.
Rick, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Friends from Berlin, tell us how a good sausage can be just the thing for a hearty snack or meal in Germany. But first, we remember a writer from Tucson in one of his last radio interviews who wrote about life in Cuba, Latin America, and the American Southwest. It's Travel with Rick Steves.